Our second presentation this afternoon is called Recognizing the Unrecognized on the archives of the Voices of Native Nations radio program on KPOO in San Francisco. It's a presentation by Neil McLean and Mary Jean Robertson of the New College of California in San Francisco. Mary Jean's father was born in Fairfax, Oklahoma in 1920. 4 years later, he became a citizen of the United States when American Indians were granted citizenship. Mary Jean is a member of the Cherokee Nation and a member of the Bird Clan. The Bird Clan members were the messengers for the people, and as a radio producer and interviewer for 37 years, Mary Jean has sent out lots of messages. Most of the actualities you will hear are part of the legacy archive from recordings of the radio shows and interviews for the show. Voices of the Native Nations is still on the air on KPOO Radio, 89.5 FM in San Francisco, and KPOO.com all over the world. Neil McLean and Mary Jean Robertson founded the Center for Unauthorized Repairs in 2001. Their intention has been to support independent media makers in their efforts to reframe core narratives. They've focused on supporting community radio programmers in their efforts to integrate anti-war and deep democracy frameworks into daily events by hosting seminars for programmers and activists. Neil has also taught at the New College of California and built a multi-purpose broadcast theater and meeting space in order to research the effects of live radio broadcasting on trauma recovery and liberation. So, I give you Neil McLean and Mary Jean Robertson.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I just wanted to let you guys know some of the little things that we go through when we're preparing for something like this. Before we start, I have this tape that I just found last night when I went home last night to do the radio show, because it's on Wednesday nights. And the radio show, on the radio show last night, we got a call in from The Longest Walk 2, which is going on right now. So I have a tape of the radio show that I'm giving to Neil so that maybe he could, you know, put it into our
This is really from last night. We've been trying to get, we promised you all a tape from The Longest Walk Now, and I didn't have time to get it in, so maybe.
Wait. This tape here is a tape that I just discovered, you know, a couple of days ago that might have Rigoberta Menchú before she was a Nobel Prize singing the Shield of the Lay of Shield Baobá. So I just wanted to bring those, and maybe we could put them in. Oh, well, maybe we better stick with what we've already got.
In the end, she gets wise. We've got a pretty, about 25 minutes of pretty much set up stuff to share with you here. So I think we're about to go. What we wanted to do is help you recognize this image.
There will be
and this sound.
More of an attitude of self-determination rather than termination, one of mutual respect.
Very happy to be here tonight. Many problems seem to be now breaking out all over the country. Like this, it might be elders prophesied there'll be like this, and it's up to us Native people, original Native people in this land, will have to start coming together in this fashion with our white brothers and sisters who are now beginning to understand that better the struggle that Native people are going through all these years. When young people took over Alcatraz, it was to me the beginning of the struggle actually, by young people from West Directions. According to the prophecy, they would push our native people across the country to the western edge of land someday. And by the time that they reached western edge of the land, many of our young people would be able to understand white man's language, able to read and write and understand some of the things that were put in writing. And they would start questioning them. And they would make an attempt to demonstrate or do something. There may be a little violence that creates in order to try to stop and change and correct some of these things. When they took that Alcatraz over, it to me is the fulfillment of that prophecy, because they call themselves our tribe at that time. And it is the way our elders say that many of our people be gathered here.
In introduction, I'd like to say that many active parts of the our own recent past and our own people's lives that we have lived and our own relatives have lived included Alcatraz and included all these walks and included the Wounded Knee and included the caravan to Washington, D.C. in 1972. But many people don't really know that Alcatraz itself sparked a great move back to the land and back to reclaiming our land for Indian people. And evidence of this today are several different communities and activities and organizations going on, to include DQ University up near Davis, to include a museum in Seattle that was a result of a land occupation and still is functioning today, Indian-owned and operated, Indian Board of Directors. And the Toyo-Wintu people, the 1960s and 70s, were landless people to many extent. And so they reclaimed back that old sawmill that had become a little company town, a little, you know the term, company town. And that had been a company town for 50 years. And in 1971, Pitt River people, Toyo-Wintu people, and many other Indian people, Indians of all tribes, Indian people of all nations, occupied and liberated this community, this company town.
You start about the beginnings of thought, or the reawakening of thought, that particular time, that the Indians of the continent should be able to begin to articulate the demands that they sought. Just the idea of to gain or regather strength, to begin again. It's hard to fight for 500 years for something you want and see the generations before you get nothing and die off. And he thought it was never too late that I should begin each generation. If he was born to the future generations and the Indians were in the same position, he would do it again as we should do it again.
Ricky Gemmel is from Pitt River. He's a Pitt River man. Good evening. My name is Mickey Gemmel, and I'm both Pitt River and Windhoek. I've been asked to represent the residents in the Toyon Windhoek Indian community. We're located in Northern California's Shasta County, approximately 7 or so miles north of Redding, California. We're near Shasta Lake and Shasta Dam. But we're facing a real serious life and death struggle to keep 61 acres that we've lived on, possessed for the last 17 years. Toyon was created and established by the Pitt River Tribe, but with the assistance of Indians of all tribes and the people that were involved in Alcatraz and most of the movement activities on the West Coast. In 1971, we started organizing to attempt to reclaim land for Windhoek Indians in 1970. It was also at the same time that we were working on reclaiming Pitt River Indian land in Northern California. We were trying to stop the Land Claims Settlement Act at that time. Approximately 200 people occupied Toyon in May of 1971. And it was a free Indian community. It was the only land at that time that eventually Indians were allowed to live in and, you know, have a normal existence.
Bottles of wine on dirty corners in the Eddy Street ghetto, Union Square, the Mission Barrio, any place where the third world gather. I know of a time our men in hate fell on a Yukon village and trading post. 100 people woke and died in a night of terror, shrieks, figures running, fire and blood. No one remembers it now. But some of us must believe and struggle and keep on saying that as a people, we will survive. I'm so happy to see so many survivors in this room. I have this feeling, this wonderful feeling of solidarity. And when everybody was up here, the walkers, I just felt that we've got strong men together, and I don't know how we can lose. I don't know how we possibly can lose.
A few things I just wanted to say. Before I came to California, I knew DQ exists, but I didn't know what all the talk and what was really going on there. I've done a lot of, and there's a lot of ways I wanted to help my people. So one way was through Dennis, and I started that way, and I wound up at DQ. And what really comes down to the bottom line for Indian survival is knowledge. And at DQ, you get that knowledge faster and better than any other grassroots organization can give you. Because you work at your pace, not someone else's. That's all I want to say.
But the next day, our grandfather, David Managi, a Hopi man from Hopi, he began to praise 104 years old. And like, for those of you who don't know what their medicine is, it's Hopi to carry blessed, like a cornmeal. But it's been blessed, and they use that when they pray. And David's a very real man. And he took his bag out, and because these guys, the United Nations, are pretty staunch characters, pretty straight, because they used to see guys come up in Cadillacs, Mercedes, and that kind of thing. David stood up and he said, "Before I talk to you, I want to pray." And he stood up and pulled out his bag and went, started throwing that stuff all over. You didn't throw it all over the table and everything. These guys are all stiff-shirted everywhere looking at him. But he made his point. But he told about a tribal government that existed since 1934, and which we know as the Reorganization Act. And then, but he told us some results of it in very graphic terms. He said that his brother-in-law happened to be one of the tribal chairmen, and he was, he said he was screwing a young lady down there when he wasn't supposed to be doing it. You know, that's the kind of reality that David laid on him. They couldn't budge away from rhetoric or English terms trying to soft soap it. And David didn't try to soft soap it either. He told them that, and the results of what that kind of government did to his people. So that we learn from David, we learn from each other daily.
It amazes me that elders know about these things that maybe some of the white people would do, even some of God in the White House, which is supposed to represent justice and fair, cleanliness, honesty, truthfulness. But that White House inside, there may be a corruption, lying and cheating and plundering of people continue. That White House is going to crash because of its own corruption someday. These are some of the problems. It seems to be getting close to that time. And those in the leaders in there would become so greedy, so selfish, become so corrupt that they don't care what they do to the people. They're going to continue to grab more power, more money, more glory, more just good time. They will not care what they do to the people. And we seem to be rushing into that right now.
Today, the United States passes $1 trillion in terms of its national economy. That was undreamed of even 25 years ago, and of course undreamed of 190 years ago, when this was a small country of 3 million people in 13 states, and very, very poor and very, very weak. We are the richest nation in the history of the world and will remain so. That $1 trillion shows one side of the strength of America. But today, in the eloquent comments of Mr. Romero, we saw another side. A side that money cannot measure. Eloquence, a deep spiritual quality, and the strength that the Indian people, the first Americans, have given to America generally in their contribution to this nation. I've often spoken of the fact that one of the men that influenced me the most in my college career happened to be my football coach, who was an American Indian. Not because he taught me to play football, I never made the team, but because he had character, strong, indomitable character. And in those Depression years, he got into everybody that was on that squad. And I want you to know that to have these eloquent remarks today on this occasion shows us that our Indian people, who are a small part of America in numbers, have made an enormous contribution because they have given great character to so many parts of our country. We're grateful for that. And on this occasion, as we look at that $1 trillion, we want to remember that the Indians in the United States of America have contributed something that no $1 trillion could ever possibly estimate. Thank you very much.
I had a very good time. It took me a bit to get into it because of the immensity of its aim. It never occurred to me that, see, I used to shoot dope here in Mission District. And it always kind of like confounds me, man. Like I find myself in a, like even sitting up here, it gets confusing sometimes. But because I used to be down, you know, I used to bag of stuff up here about 3 blocks away, you know. And to know that I was able to stay alive because of people with a political belief supported me and cared for me in that way and were able to educate me, and I'm still being educated, is to see that myself in Geneva taking part in contributing to such a historical thing. It was really a shock for about a day there. But once we got underway, the feelings were good, very unexplainable. But I have to tell you, it was probably the greatest high of my life. When we begin to work together, we also begin to relax together. We also begin to have ceremonies together. And we found that their beliefs were so much like ours. And then we found that we were one, you know. And that power, that unity, it really overwhelmed not only us, because it was almost like love at first sight, because once the only barrier we had to overcome was a language barrier. And once we began to understand that we were fighting the same enemy, then we understood each other very well. And it was a very rewarding thing.
It's international thrust and support. In a very few years, many of our people, because of the plans of energy, will be extinct. And that's on top of many of our people who are already extinct. We're losing our people, our fishing rights, our water rights, our land rights, every right, every human right, every right of an individual person and a people and a culture to live that only enriches the rest of the world is being killed by the United States government in this United States.
So that they cannot have another wounded knee. They cannot actually go and shoot him down. So they kind of let him go. And of course they charge him with a kind of trunk of charges and call him in troublemakers, any name you can think of, just to make their names so bad that they are run down, shut down, thrown in jail, like Leonard Peltier and others, Dennis Bank is still being followed. These are some of the promises our Hopi people talked about in 1948. It really amazes me that elders know about these things that maybe some of the white people would do.
How did that all turn out for your own trial, John?
Well, I had some legal problems in Nevada, and in the course of 9 months, I was tried and I was arrested and tried in three different jurisdictions, federal jurisdiction, tribal jurisdiction, and state jurisdiction. And it turned into a big jurisdictional question as to who had jurisdiction, but I won in all three jurisdictions. So in April of this year, the Nevada Supreme Court ruled. In the last jurisdiction I was in was in state jurisdiction, and the Nevada Supreme Court ruled that the state had no jurisdiction over me because the crime I was accused of happened on an Indian reservation. But more basic than that, I was accused of a crime that never happened, which I think is purely unusual. I mean, I know of a lot of people that have been framed for an alleged crime that did happen, but I was charged with something that never ever happened by the state. And I thought it was kind of ironic that the Supreme Court, when they made the ruling in my favor, was they made the ruling that the state had no jurisdiction over me for a crime that never happened. I mean, that's all it came down to in the end. You know, but I put it in this context, is that if I, as a member of the Santee Sioux tribe, that if I convened an all-Indian grand jury, you know, and then I decided to pick the first white person that I saw, and I'm going to hold you, white person, I'm going to hold you responsible for all the crimes of your government. And I'm going to my Indian grand jury, my secret grand jury, who I refuse to give you the names of. And we're going to convene and we're going to hand down an indictment and find you guilty of all the crimes of your government against us. And then I would go get my Indian police and have my Indian police go into the white community, take this white man out of his community and bring him into the Indian community, and he put him in front of an all-Indian jury, in front of an Indian judge under Indian laws with Indian lawyers, see, and in taking the court, you know. And I think if we did something of that nature?
The Aboriginal people of Australia were not treated with. There was no treaty, there was no negotiation, there was nothing. They were considered, animals, part of the flora and fauna of Australia. Aboriginal people were not even citizens until 21 years ago. And we thought it was bad when we weren't citizens until the 20s. Aboriginal people became citizens in 1967, 68, something like that. And it was only then that they were even considered to be human beings, able to be educated, or in any way live and take care of themselves.
This land was linked with a spiritual road by the great spirit, and we put us on there to take care of it that way. But when the white brotherhood turned aside from the spiritual way to push our people and then missions, rolling this rug clear over to western edge of land, taking everything. So now young people have to rise up here on the western edge of land and roll it back right up to the door of White House by carrying this peace pipe on this long walk. There are indications that those things that events take place, the Hopi process is being fulfilled right along that place in that time. It developed according to that prophecy.
In this country, most Americans feel that individual rights of citizenship preclude and take over the group rights. And the way that this works in a lot of areas is with the attribute that particularly in the United States of America, individual rights include the rights of corporations who, as a legal fiction, are individuals. And I have felt on numerous occasions that it is the exact opposite that should be upheld, that villages and communities and organizations should have the ability to act as groups so that they have their own rights to land, their philosophy, their cultures, their communities. And that's why this indigenous rights passage in the UN is so important, because as tribal people, as indigenous nations, we have a right and a responsibility to communities to maintain our culture and our languages and our religions and our land base as groups of people, not just individual people.
That's it for the slides.
So we're a group of people that listen to sounds, and a lot of times people on the internet and in networks and stuff like that always complain that there's not much access to a lot of historical information. Content is missing a lot of times. So with a little bit more support, as we were saying, you know, all of these sounds are on like a stack of cassette tapes in somebody's house. And in order to, some of them are even not labeled. So in order to really work with that and to digitalize them and make them accessible to people on the web, it would be really good to be able to find people that are interested in the history, that are interested in doing work to get that history accessible to more people. And what we would like to see is the ability of young Indian men and women to be able to be paid to do something like that. So that's our hope and our dream and vision.
Okay. So we'd be open for questions.
Any questions?
Yes.
San Francisco State still has an ethnic studies department. I think Cornell University has a pretty good group of folks that are working in Native studies. A lot of people in the 60s and 70s had a lot of activism going on, and there were a lot of ethnic studies departments that were started in. A lot of them have now been subsumed into other areas. So it's really difficult to say, because it's like everything else. You don't know what's going to continue and what is going to die an unnatural death, as we have found to our sorrow. New College is one of the dying institutions at this point. So.
I'd respond briefly to say the San Francisco State University just added a Native American Studies department a few years ago, and now there's cuts, and so they're expecting actually for it to be cut back. The one at Berkeley, we're in contact with the individuals there, but they're actually associated with the student union. They're not really part of a university program, and they're looking to us to help them get support to do the archiving. So I think the answer is no, as far as we can tell so far. And what we had been trying to do, as Mary Jean just mentioned, was to work with a very small liberal college in the Mission District of San Francisco. And we've done quite a bit of work there over the last 5 years. And this February, it is closing.
Any other questions?
I will add one other thing to that, which continues to surprise me, and Mary Jean continues to point out, is that one of the things we have done is to try to work with Ohlone people, who are the indigenous to the Bay Area. And it's phenomenal, the lack of resources, when you start to really look at it. So that the center that we have had on Valencia Street has been one of the few places that would present them in a regular way, give them a space to go on the radio, for example. So that within San Francisco itself, there are no Ohlone services of any kind formally. There is a woman in San Jose who has a small nonprofit organization. And that's really the extent of publicly accessible, or it's really a private nonprofit, but an organization that someone could join or support that has to do with supporting Ohlones. So there's this interesting dimension where, in an international sense, there's quite a bit more support than there is within the United States. And that's one of the things we were trying to indicate here, is that though the movement still grows and there's considerable momentum within it, within the United States, the institutions still continue to really exclude it, repress it.
Aren't there any pan-Indian organizations that sort of especially cater to people in the greater Southwest, in New Mexico and Arizona, who may have more of an organizational outlook on all of this and document things?
Pan-Indian? Is that Revere where? Sorry. Yeah, there are organizations that are, another organization that was also started around 1948 was the National Congress of American Indians, and there were several organizations and agencies that are like multinational agencies, but they're more along the lines of what David Menangi was talking about, the tribal chairman's organizations, where they have a great deal of corruption because they're funded by the federal governments in order to control the resources of those nations. So it's really difficult to sort of negotiate between the resource-rich tribes who are controlled by federally appointed officials to get to the actual grassroots people who are being affected by all of those imposed federal regulations. So it's kind of an iffy proposition, you know. Yeah, there are.
There may be a connection that we haven't built yet. I'm not going to say there isn't. I am saying we have looked and we have so far not discovered it.
Have you spoken to UC Berkeley?
Yes.
Okay, is that Native American Studies, John Berry, or librarian?
Yes, we've spoken with John Berry a few times, and he's actually the person I was referring to when I said we were trying to search for grants, and he was like, great, maybe I can get some training from you guys.
What? He actually is very supportive. It's just that he has very little support from the administration himself.
So that's our dilemma.
Anyway, thank you for watching. Really, really a pleasure to see so many people get to see and hear some of the things we've been doing for the last 35 years.